Good afternoon and welcome to Digging Deep, a farming show brought to you by WDRT Community Radio 91.9 coming from Viroqua, Wisconsin. And you can listen to this show by going to our website, wdrt.org, and listening to previously broadcast programs. We call them locally produced, and you'll find who's in the kitchen, and maybe you'll find Digging Deep as a separate show. I'm Philothea Beeson, and after doing a food show for about 10 years here on WDRT, I thought, we got to have a show on farming, because farming is where food comes from, and I just felt like it was really important to know how we get to eat and what's all involved. And so we just started with a show last, the end of October, and we're going to be airing the farming show, Digging Deep, the last Saturday of every month at noon, in taking the place of Who's in the Kitchen. And I'll be the host for both. And we started last month with Alan Filo, and he's on again because we did not finish the history of agriculture in 1 hour. And so he's joined us to continue where we left off. And I hope that if you're interested, that you'll go back and listen to the first hour. It will be, his is kind of like a little mini course to give us a broad view of the development of agriculture from the beginning of mankind. And we hope to all get right up to modern times, but we might not get that far in this coming hour. But I want to welcome Alan to the show. Welcome, Alan.
Hello.
And he's a good friend of mine and a farmer who lives near Dodgeville. And I was very interested in his farming practices and the kind of animals he raised and the attention he pays to his feed and pastures and to the animals themselves. And so we decided that we would try to put together the beginning of this show. And thank you so much, Alan, for joining us.
Well, it's nice to actually be up here in Viroqua, where we hope the sound quality will now be a little bit better since we're both in the same room. I always like coming up to Viroqua, partially because I want to get a burrito at the co-op when we're done. And I'll probably go over to Wonder State Coffee and caffeinate myself before I head home as well.
It's a fun little town.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed it.
Well, you come up this way to get your meat processed too, I think. Some of your...
Yeah, I have. Sometimes we've had some of our lambs processed up at Nordic Meats, which is just south of Westby there. And then, actually, it's kind of funny you mentioned that because I have to stop in Plain, Wisconsin on the way home and pick up 5 lambs we took in last week, so which is good because our freezers are empty.
Oh, so what abattoir is that?
That's Straka's. So if you're Straka's. From like around Spring Green, you'll recognize that name. They've been there for a long time, and they do a really nice job. So
good, and I think you've been going up to Cashton too.
Yeah, I think we went up there. Yeah, we went up there a couple times. You know, it's interesting during COVID, during the pandemic. Abattoirs, it became really, really difficult to get a spot in an abattoir. That I've learned more and more about that. I was told recently, and I've found this totally fascinating, and I would love to investigate this more, because I had a lot of friends that said, you know, we've been a small farm going to this small meat processor for years, and suddenly you couldn't, they were getting bumped during COVID. And I maybe people didn't follow this a lot, but one of the things that happened and one of the things that's happened in this country over time is that there's only a few large meat processors. And so when those meat processors got hit with COVID and they had to shut down, there were, you know, there's this huge pipeline of hogs, of steers, of all these things that need to go to these abattoirs or to these large meat packing plants. And they didn't have anywhere to go. There were a lot of animals that were basically just euthanized and lost. We weren't able to put them into the food system. But I've heard that there was actually some pressure even put on these small abattoirs to bump some of the smaller farmers to take in some of the like overflow from the closing of these other meat plants while they were closed. So I don't know that that's the case, but it's very it's a very interesting phenomenon that happened. So we had to start casting around. It got very hard to find a spot to get animals processed, and even now you have to schedule out 6 months to a year, whereas you used to be able to call up and get a spot, you know, in a month. So
very interesting. A part of the meat market anyway.
Yep.
Well, just to recap a little bit, not everybody who listens to WDRT heard my last show. So we could just kind of recap. We were trying to go back really to the time of Adam and Eve, I suppose, and say, you know, leaving the Garden of Eden and going out and having, as you said, having the curse of having to till the soil agriculture has had a long history and has developed, and we were going through different countries, different parts of the world where it flourished and then where it spread.
So we had talked about how agriculture arose, as far as we can tell, in the hill country around the Fertile Crescent, and then moved from there down into the river valleys and was the basis for the major Mesopotamian civilizations and the Egyptian civilization. And we talked some about the tools and the way that these were highly civilized, extremely intelligent people that had created tools that could meter out very specific amounts of seed. They were getting predictable returns, predictable yields, and this was really the basis for their societies. But then what happened was, and we had started talking about where agriculture went after that, how it had start to spread out and what the consequences were from taking tools and techniques that had been developed in river valley systems and what happens when they move into places that aren't river valley systems. So I had mentioned last time that there was this interesting phenomenon where originally when agriculture started to expand out of the Mediterranean, it would sort of hit these spots where it would stop. One of these interesting spots archaeologically is a place called the Danube Gates. And agriculture basically went up to this spot on a map in the Balkans and didn't get past it for 1,000 years. And there's a lot of theories as to why that occurred, but I think that I kind of wanted to go back to there and start talking about that again. It's important to remember that when we're talking about agricultural crops, those agricultural crops, right, they especially at a time before we have any of the like protective things that we have now, crop protection systems where we could take a crop maybe outside of its regular growing conditions, and if it's stressed and would be open to like insect attack or fungal disease or things like, we have things that we can do to protect that, insecticides and fungicides. I'm not saying that those are good things, but they allow us to go outside of the bounds of where a plant would usually be able to survive. Well, if you think that I have this wheat plant, right, and these wheat seeds, and I've carried them up from Mesopotamia, and that's a semi-arid environment with very regular rainfall patterns. It doesn't rain a lot in the spring and the summer. It rains mainly through the winter. That moisture gets stored. These plants grow in very dry conditions. They're not subject to a lot of different molds and mildews and things like that. So if I have this seed, and I can maybe grow that in the lower Balkans, but if I try to get past a certain, basically like climactic, leaving one climactic zone into another, and I enter into a temperate forest system, right, which is really what you get into when you get into the northern Balkans and you start to get into Central Europe and even Western Europe, well, these seeds don't have necessarily the ability to defend themselves from whatever is up there. We actually see this, interestingly enough, with maize, with the spread of maize in North and South America, which is that maize was originally developed in Oaxaca, and it went south quite a ways down into where the through Central America and down into like Northern South America, and it went up through most of Mexico, and then it sort of hit its like climactic wall that it couldn't get past. And then there was some sort of, and the only way that we have any evidence for this is we basically have been able to look at archaeologically, you know, midden piles, so like trash piles, and we can assess, even do some like archaeological, like radioisotope dating of and looking at people's teeth from archaeological finds so we can see what they were eating.
Oh my gosh.
But we can tell that corn got up to a certain point and then kind of got stuck there, and then it must have had a sudden mutation that allowed it to grow at northern latitudes, because suddenly it went from like kind of like stuck, I think it was somewhere around Texas, and then suddenly it went all the way to Maine, right, and even up into like southern Canada. Like mm-hmm. you could suddenly grow it there. So I think it's safe to assume that a similar thing probably happened with some of these, you know, grain varieties. Now, there could have been cultural issues there, too. I'm not too familiar with what they would have been called barbarians at the time. The northern barbarians on the edge of the Roman Empire would have been doing, or would they be growing what? I don't know. Would they have had enough of a settled society to even do some farming? I don't know. But it's interesting because suddenly you get it passes kind of over this climactic hurdle and it spread out all over Europe. But it did so, and this is where it gets very interesting and a little bit more tied into soils. It did it only on one particular soil type, and that these were loess-based soils. We're in Wisconsin, and we have loess-based soils here. So loess is a wind-borne sediment, or you'll hear me say aeolian, wind deposit. So basically what happens is that there are certain rocks, there are certain minerals that will erode and fractionate down to a level where they can become airborne.
Oh, uh-huh.
And it's only a certain set of minerals, which leads to a very interesting phenomenon, which is that loess, doesn't matter where you go in the world, looks about the same, right? It has about the same chemical characteristics. It's full of a lot of calcitic minerals, so these are carbonate minerals like limestones, and then they have a lot of what are pre-alitic clay minerals, so micas. That can develop into clays
mm-hmm.
and that have a lot of potassium stored in them. So they have a very very silty. They're a silty structure. So they're not like clays, which are very 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 fine and heavy. And they're not like sand, which is right. Like it's very hard. Unless I'm in the Sahara and I have these really crazy, you know, sandstorms, like it's hard to get big sand particles airborne. So it's just this kind of like this certain fractionation of in terms of size that can become airborne, and then when it settles, it becomes the basis for a soil, for a loess-based soil, and you find these heavy deposits of loess in certain parts of the world. So you find them all across actually Europe. You find them
like the bread baskets of various places.
That's exactly right.
You
find there's loess deposits in China. It's very interesting. When we haven't really talked about the Far East and what happens as agriculture goes to the Far East. But you know, the part of what happened in China was that China had its own agriculture develop, and it was a rice-based agriculture. But it also ended up with wheat in the northern reaches of China, and that wheat came from the Middle East, from the southwestern agricultural complex. And I remember reading a paper years ago in which this researcher was wondering why when wheat got to China, it wasn't grown like in these hill places where it was often grown in Mesopotamia. And because he thought that it would want the same kind of like land structures. I'm not exactly sure why he thought this, but I thought it was so interesting because he even said instead it went and it was grown on this loess plain, right? Well, what's interesting about this is that the soils that these plants originally grew up on are kind of like a lust-based soil. They're not a lust-based soil, but they look a lot like it. They have higher pHs, they have a lot of alkalinity, they had a lot of potassium that was available in the soil, and so these plants are adapted to a soil that looks like this, right? And so whenever these plants would encounter lust, you see that's where these become the breadbaskets. These mm-hmm. become places mm-hmm. where it can go. And another kind of piece of evidence for that is that you see the agricultural spread across Europe, but it stops right when it gets to the ends of these lust deposits as it gets close to the coast. And the soil types completely change.
Oh, right. Well, another thing that I was thinking about is the arboreal nature of Europe. You know, you compare that to Mesopotamia or Egypt, where there's no trees. I mean, it's a completely different kind of landscape.
Right. And that is almost solely because you have very different, basically, moisture regimens. So the rainfall is much heavier in Europe, and it's cooler, of course, than in these other more arid places. And that's what allows for the tree growth. But when agriculture did get there and did spread, it was found that if you cut down those forests, right, that the soils underneath those forests, these lust-based soils, was very conducive to agriculture. But then you start also having problems occur, right? So as we mentioned last time, there were techniques that were developed that traveled. You have to think of agriculture spreading as not just the spread of a seed, but basically as like this like technology package that's moving across the landscape. And almost a cultural package too, because you would see cultures change as agriculture comes in. You'll see people move from like maybe a semi-nomadic way of life to like a fully settled way of life, right? And so that obviously is going to be a lot of cultural changes within that society. But along with those seeds, you're going to get, well, this is how, you know, if you think of like somebody just telling somebody else, they go, how do I plant this seed? Well, the first thing you do is you're going to plow the ground, right? That's what somebody's going to tell you. How do I plant a garden? Well, the first thing you need to do is you're going to need to till it up, right? That's mm-hmm. usually where people start. So you can see that even now it's kind of like this, it's a technology package. It's a set of seeds and it's a set of techniques that all go together. So, you know, when this is moving into Europe, people are still taking plows and things right into Europe. These same techniques that were used in the river valleys are now going to be used in forests after the trees are cut down. And that, because those early plows, when we think of those plows now, they're not like a plow that you would see on a farm today. What we have on farms today is something that is called a moldboard plow. That was actually originally developed in China and made its way into Europe during the Middle Ages. And most of the time, that the mold, it had varying levels of metal, but often it was like a wooden plowshare. But at this time, this was even before the moldboard plow, and we basically had what were called stick plows. So you can pretty much imagine something that looks like a plow, but instead of that metal share at the bottom that can slice and cut roots, and instead of that big moldboard wing that's made to take a sod and invert it, and also it helps break the soil and aerate the soil, you basically have a smaller or larger stick at the bottom of the plow that's being dragged through the soil, basically to just kind of loosen it and free it up. So the amount of soil disturbance you get with that kind of a tool isn't like what we have now. So these plows, in that sense, people now like to talk about a plow being destructive. I want to kind of stay away from that terminology, and I just want to say like it creates less disturbance in the soil. Now remember,
The stick plow.
Uh-huh. And remember that disturbance can be a positive thing in a soil, depending on what it is we want to accomplish. So these particular plows created less disturbance. So they the effects of them moving from this, you know, river valley to a forest wasn't as big as what we would necessarily imagine. But what you do have, one of the main problems that develops, is that you don't have the constant influx of new fertility, right? Because in the river valley, you get the floods, you get the deposition of silt. It's interesting side note, in Egypt, in ancient Egypt, the value of your land was actually partially determined by how much silt you were going to get per year.
Oh, it, my gosh.
Deposited. So the best land was the ones that would get like through this, like a certain amount, because it, mm-hmm. because it was actually that predictable. Those floods, the Nile is a very unique river in that the floods are that predictable. And the farther you were away and the less silt you got, then the less valuable your land was,
mm-hmm.
because basically you weren't getting as much free fertilizer. So, so what we see then happening, and this starts to happen especially in the Roman Empire, because you have to remember the Romans went up and they conquered Gaul, modern day France. They even conquered England. And so they were farming in these temperate places, and they had developed basically crop rotations to be able to restore soil fertility, which is something you didn't necessarily have to do as much of in river valley systems. So this is some of the first times that you see people mentioning that we want to do legumes and then follow the legume with a grain crop, because the legume is going to put nitrogen back mm-hmm. in. Or you see people starting to talk about manuring and the necessity of manuring. And there were whole and these systems, by the way, were intact probably into the 1800s and even later than that in places like China. There were whole industries for people to remove quote unquote night soil from cities. So basically sewage, and get it back out to the farms, because people recognized that we are taking all of this fertility off of these farm fields. It's moving into the cities, and we need to, you know, they understood that sewage isn't just sewage. That's actually fertility. It needs to come back out and get back
right,
on the fields.
Right. Well, sewage is a problem when there's too much of it, and that's what we're just always trying to balance this out. Too much manure in one place,
yeah.
not enough manure in another
yeah.
place. And I just want to take a break. You're listening to Digging Deep, a farming show on WDRT Community Radio, 91.9 FM, and streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org. We're coming from Viroqua, Wisconsin. I'm Philothea Beeson, and I'm talking with Alan Filo from Dodgeville, and he's just giving us a little quick tour of the development of agriculture. And we'll just continue. But we were just talking about manure and night soil and the importance of restoring the fertility of soil after you've been farming it.
Right.
I don't know if you realize this. I didn't really, really put it together for myself for a long time. That crops, when they grow, they require nutrients that are in the soil. And if they keep growing in the same place, they're drawing more out, and pretty soon the soil does not have those nutrients, and we have to do something about it, right?
Yes, that's correct. And so up until the advent of the invention of mineral fertilizers, which we'll talk about later, but mineral fertilizers in really the first half and into the mid part of the 20th century, there were only a few ways that were techniques for restoring soil fertility, and most of them involved fallowing or crop rotation. So fallowing is the practice of actually just letting a farm field go and let it grow whatever it wants to grow for a year, or maybe 2 years, or maybe 3 years. You know, obviously you'd manage it. If you do that for too long, I think people have observed this. If you ever see an old farm field that's let go, after about 3 years, it's full of raspberries and multiflora rose and brambles. And if you give it a few more years, suddenly it's got poplar trees in it and black locust. And in 20 years, it's a forest again, right? So when you fallow something, it might still be managed or mowed or even grazed in order to keep those brushy species from starting to invade it. But the idea there is that you're going to grow a crop that's going to extract a lot of these nutrients, but then I need a way to build those nutrients up. So let's say that this is a place where I can't get manure to readily or something like that. Well, you know what? Plants have this relationship with microbes in the soil. You have to wonder if I have a, let's say I just have a piece of ground that basically just had a bunch of lus like deposited on it or something like that. Well, that's not really a soil yet, right? It's not really a soil until I have it really colonized by microbiology and growing plants, because soil is really a complex matrix of both like physical and biological interactions. And there's a relationship that plants have with the microbes in the soil, and the microbes are very fascinating creatures. You know, if you want to think about being that small for just a little bit and what it would mean, it means that you can't travel. And then it simultaneously means that you are at the mercy of anything that wants to make you travel. Right? So you could suddenly change the context of where you're living randomly and very quickly from your perspective, right? If you're a microbe. If I'm a microbe living close to the surface of the soil and the soil dries out and a big wind comes, I could become a windborne microbe and I could land in a place that is completely unlike where I was just living, right? So microbes are really fascinating because microbes, bacteria, they have, they're not primitive, right? They're been around for possibly longer than us or the same time as us, or but they've been going along at least as long as we have. And the whole time they've been adapting to their environments. And what's fascinating about them is they have multiple ways of extracting energy from the environment encoded into their genome. But that makes sense based on what I just told you, right? Because let's say that I'm a microbe living sort of like by a plant root. And that's a nice place to be because the plants will feed you sugar. We'll talk about more of that in a second. So the plants will feed you sugar and you're going to give certain things back to the plants, but that's a nice place to live. So I can just be sitting here nice eating this sugar and processing it aerobically just like we do.
And reproducing oneself.
And reproducing oneself. But suddenly there's a flood and I get picked up in the flood. And I'm transported way downstream and I got buried like 4 feet deep. And there's no oxygen. Well, what am I going to do? I have three options. I can sporulate, which means I can basically encase myself in a hard coating and go to sleep, which is very effective, right? They can wake up sporulated microbes out of Antarctic tundra, which has been encased in ice for who knows how long.
Wow.
And these microbes wake up and start doing their microbe things, okay? So
good or ill.
or I can die. That is sort of ineffective in trying to continue microbe life. Or I can switch to a different, basically, set of tools to process energy and to keep getting energy out of the environment. So I might switch to an anaerobic method of processing sugar and different things around me, right? Which is, it's less efficient. Like for the amount of energy I put into that system, I get less energy out than with aerobic respiration, but I still get a positive energy gain. So I can still reproduce and do the things I want to do. I might even switch to being a lithotroph, which means that I start eating rocks, because we don't think about rocks having energy in them, but and unless you want to go to the crystal shop down the road. But we don't think about rocks containing energy, but there are energy gradients that exist in the way that a rock is put together and what's going to happen to it when it gets exposed to oxygen, right? And microbes will take advantage of those little tiny bits of basically like energy waterfalls, and they'll get energy out of that. I mean, it's totally amazing. I know they found one microbe in the ocean that had every known respiration pathway that we know of in it. You could literally take this microbe and put it in any environment and it would live because it had an ability to get energy out of that environment.
That is amazing. Well, and I'm thinking, okay, when did they discover microbes? This is pretty recent history to even know that there are little tiny things that you can't see.
That's true, but it doesn't really matter if you know that they're there. They're still there.
They knew it somehow intuitively by what they did and what worked and what didn't work.
They knew what worked, but they didn't necessarily know why it worked. Mm-hmm. So the fallowing, what it does, this started with fallowing. What it does is that if I have not a lot of nutrients that are available to plants, because plants are kind of lazy, right? They just want to suck like a readily available nutrient kind of like out of the soil water solution. They might take them an amino acid here or there, but I'm not going to like go through the work of breaking down a rock to get some nutrient out of it, right? They kind of can, but it's way more effective if I can feed a microbe some sugar and the microbe has better like enzymatic pathways for breaking the rock down and getting at the nutrients, right? So there's this deal that happens. Down in soils, there's something around the roots called the rhizosphere. And the rhizosphere is just this amazing place of all this biological activity where the plant is putting out sugars into the soil and the microbes are eating those sugars. But the microbes then might be, you know, short on a nutrient. So they're going to go and get this nutrient either out of a rock or out of the air. I mean, that's why legumes work, is because legumes have little colonies of microbes that form these nodules. And what they're doing is they're taking N2, nitrogen, out of the air, and they're forming it into ammonium and putting it into amino acids in their body, in their little microbe bodies. And what the plant's doing is giving them sugar while they're doing that to let them live. And then what the plant eventually is going to get is that nitrogen, right? Mm-hmm. Which it doesn't have a way to get in other ways. There's even really interesting, really recent research about geophagy, which is this absolutely crazy thing where microbes will slip, the plants will draw the microbes into the, between the cell wall, which is, plants have this very thick cell wall, between the cell wall and the inner membrane. So they're in this kind of like interstitial space, and then they will basically produce this enzyme and this set of signals that causes the cell wall of the microbe to like collapse, and they'll suck a whole bunch of like cytoplasm out of the microbe and then let the microbe reform its cell wall and then spit it back out into the environment. So it's literally like eating a portion of the microbe, but not entirely. It's like the plant is farming the microbes. It's completely amazing stuff. So what happens, though, in a fallow system is that those kinds of processes are going forward. I have plants that I'm not trying to harvest, or I might let a cow eat them, and they're going to just recycle most of those nutrients back into the soil anyway. And what happens over a 2 or 3 year period is that the microbes are able to extract more nutrients from the environment. So if you think of it like on a field level, there's kind of like a slow increase of the total amount of nutrients that are available that have collected in this field. And then what you do is then you go back and you till the field again and you plant your grain crop, and then you capture a bunch of those nutrients in the grain crop. But what that means is that, you know, in the Middle Ages, is that maybe only like a third of the land was actually being actively farmed at any given time. But this was their way of adapting this kind of agriculture that had come out of like Mesopotamia and being able to make it something that works in that kind of environment. And these are very sustainable systems, and we know that because people did them for thousands of years effectively, and those societies did not collapse, right? I don't know how you can be more sustainable than that. You also have to remember that these were very different. Those people thought very differently than the way that we think, because we live in an extractive economy. Capitalism is extractive just by its very nature. It would be very interesting if somebody could describe to me a system of capitalism that is not extractive. But at some point, right, in capitalism, you are taking a base resource and basically you're moving it up this value chain, and everybody's trying to extract value as it goes through the system. Well, that's extractive. Everybody's trying to get something out of this original, like, base good, right? But that's not necessarily what's happening when I'm living in a subsistence society. And you have to remember that the Middle Ages, late Roman antiquity and in the Middle Ages, this is not an extractive society. This is basically a subsistence society. So I know that, well, to kind of put it back in modern terms again, it's like the farm that my wife and I own, I don't know if my son is going to be interested in agriculture, right? Because he has a choice. He could be interested in agriculture or not. So he might get the farm, but he might not. And if he doesn't get the farm, then somebody else is just going to get the farm. So, well, I would ask you, do I necessarily need to make decisions that are going to make sure that the farm is perfect for my son to take over, right? Whereas in the Middle Ages, you knew that your son was going to take over the farm. You knew that your daughter was going to marry somebody else in the village, next village over. And you knew that your grandson was probably going to be in the same place, and your great-grandson was going to be in the same place. And so you make decisions very differently in that kind of a system. Like, I might spend a lot of my free time picking up rocks from someplace a half mile away and bringing them over to the farm and taking a steep hillside and slowly terracing it to get a quarter acre more of usable ground, right? And we would look at that today and we would do a cost-benefit analysis of that and go, well, that's not worth my time, right? So do you see what I'm talking about there? This is a very different way of thinking about the way that you're living on the land.
Well, yes, and yes, your attitude toward the land, and it gets down to ownership or something about the way you look at land. Are you going to stay there? Are you going to build for the future? Are you going to farm for a while and then move on to something more fertile? Do you have that mobility to even do that?
Right, and remember that in the Middle Ages, and this existed actually in Russia all the way up until, I think, the 1880s, maybe the 1870s, was serfdom. And serfdom meant that you as a person and your family was actually tied to that particular piece of land. So it's actually almost like the opposite. Like, that land owns that family, right? As opposed to, I own that land and I can transfer, right,
it
around.
Sell it. Yeah.
Like, actually, no, you couldn't actually leave that land unless you had permission, like, from your feudal lord. Now, that's, by the way, again, that's not a judgment call. I think that feudal society is a very interesting society and had a lot, it was very successful for a very long period of time, and I think people probably lived some very good lives in feudal society, even at the peasant level. Maybe better than some people in our modern society that supposedly, quote-unquote, own their, you know, whatever, and might have the freedom to move, but whether or not they really have the freedom to move is debatable. So so that's to say, though, that people could act in more sustainable manners because they weren't living in an extractive economy, right? So they could make more sustainable choices, more naturally sustainable choices for the way that they were going to live, which meant things like what we were talking about. I'm only going to farm one-third of my land per year. And they would even decide this on like a whole village level, because there were systems, and there's still at least one village in England that does this, and it's an allotment system, which is like the people don't even own the land. It's like the village owns the land, and the village will tell you which plot you're going to farm that year.
Oh, you don't even get the same plot.
You don't get the same plot, but actually that's because of a sense of equity inside the village, recognizing that different plots have different value, and say what they would actually try to carve things up so that everybody got about the same quality of land. But I might have a strip of land over here and a strip of land over here and a strip of land over here. So it wasn't necessarily the most efficient system, but, you know, we have to think too that efficiency is a very, like, modern value, right? They didn't necessarily value that back then. Maybe they valued the equity of making sure everybody had the similar kind of land to farm, right, at that time. So to back up a second, though, it's very interesting to note when we're talking about something like that Roman agriculture did not look like that. So Roman agriculture was highly extractive. In fact, it's one of the only times in history that we see a similar form of extractive agriculture as we do today.
Oh, and then we think about Rome as rising and falling. Mm-hmm.
Well,
is it related to the way they farmed?
Not necessarily. I mean, it would be interesting to say that, but, you know, I don't think that there's really been an empire or a civilization that hasn't risen and fallen yet. And there's a lot of other impacts. Mm-hmm. I read a very good book recently that actually made a very good case that Rome, which kind of reached its height in the late hundreds of the second century AD, was actually subject to climate fluctuations, and that this actually introduced variability in basically crop production, but also allowed other new diseases to come in. It was a very interesting book. It's like, well, that might have more of an explanation, because they were successfully doing this extractive economy for mm-hmm. a number of years. But the point I want to make with that is that Rome got to this point where it had an abundance of free labor, of free energy. Through its conquest of its neighbors, it would enslave large amounts of people and basically bring them back to Rome. And these very rich landowners had basically had this free labor that they could make and go work these very large tracts of land.
Okay, yeah, so labor, right.
Labor.
But also I was thinking about empires moving. Partly they were moving to get more food. They wanted land and they wanted to feed people. No?
No, more of it was just about, some people actually say that Rome set out to defend itself and accidentally conquered an empire. Roman history is extremely fascinating because they really didn't go out and try to conquer all their neighbors. They just kept, you know, going back and punching in the mouth the next guy that came up and tried to punch them. I mean, that's how it went for about the first couple hundred years, and then things got a little bit more interesting after that. But what happened was Rome actually started out as a society that had a lot of small landowners, right? They were a republic that was based on there was a kind of an oligarchy of larger landowners, but most Romans owned about 2 acres, and they farmed that and they raised their family on that. And this was the source, we kind of touched on this last time, is like this was actually the source of Rome's power, was they had this very successful agriculture that was of these small landholders, each owning like 2 acres, and all of them had to own all of the necessities for equipping themselves to fight in the legions, and they were all in charge of teaching their son how to fight. And if you just think about how many people you can put, if I have 2 acres, if I have 100 acres, well, I could have 50 families. And from the view of Rome, that's 50 fighting men, right? So I can add up a lot of territory pretty quickly, and this is what allowed Rome to raise these legions and go out and conquer. But what happened when they would do this is that these men who should have been farming, as the empire got larger and larger and they were on these campaigns for longer and longer periods of time, they weren't at home to tend their farms. And it's very sad, but they would get back home, they would have their pay, but their farm would be destitute. And a lot of times, in order to make ends meet, they would sell their farm to like some wealthy person. And so what happened is that this patchwork of these small farms slowly developed into these incredibly large land holdings owned by very like just the top, you know, few percent of the Roman elite, and they were farmed by these large, basically by armies of slaves that had also been captured on these campaigns. And what it allowed for was commercial production agriculture, very much like what we see today. This is when you could have huge amounts of olive oil or wine production, and you could ship them all the way from Rome to Egypt, and you could ship grain from, and it wasn't necessary to grow grain anymore in the Roman Empire in Italy, because you could get all your grain from Egypt, and the grain would come up into Rome. The reason I mention this, though, really is that we have a very similar situation today, but instead of the free labor of basically slaves, what we have today is oil, which creates about the same system, which is that I don't need, you don't have basically the muscle power of one human trying to work X amount of acres, or one human, maybe with the assistance of some animals, trying to work a set of acres. Like, one person can plow 500 acres in a day with a modern piece of machinery. And if you were to go through and calculate out exactly the amount of power that takes, it's an energy it takes, it's incredible, right? So kind of shunt that off into the future for when we get to the discussions of modern agriculture and why it looks the way it does. But it's interesting to note that at least one time in antiquity, there was a very similar extractive economy that looked very much like what we have today in modern agriculture.
Very interesting. Well, I'm talking with Alan Filo. He lives in Dodgeville right now, and he's a farmer. And he's sharing with us his, just out of the top of his head, and really, his knowledge of the history of agriculture and the different practices and how they relate to what we do today here and about the world. And this is a farming show called Digging Deep. It airs on Saturdays at noon, the last Saturday of each month. And you're listening to WDRT, Community Radio, 91.9 FM, and streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org. So we have a few minutes left to wind up the show and cover maybe, I don't know, 6 centuries, 8 centuries.
Well, what's interesting is that form of agriculture, as you leave kind of late Roman antiquity and you get into the feudal societies that developed in Europe, basically agriculture just sort of stays in this form of doing these fallow systems and using some, trying to put manures back in the land and using some crop rotations and things to try to restore fertility. But basically there was a pretty hard limit to what you could get out of land. So there was a hard limit to what the European population was going to be, especially with the varieties of plants that we were growing. And the next major thing that changed was really the encounter between the old world and the new world and the Columbian Exchange. So after Columbus, right, we all know he didn't discover America, but when Columbus opened up the interchange between Europe and Asia and the Americas, this was one of the major things that really started to change agriculture going forward. And a lot of it was because of the new crops that we brought from the New World back to Europe. And just as a kind of like a teaser looking ahead, one of those crops, the potato, was so effective, so much a better, especially in poor soils, it was such a better crop than these grain crops, it caused population explosions in many of the northern countries. So you see population explosions in Germany, you see population explosions, and then the potato famine in Ireland. You see population explosions in the Scandinavian countries. And those population explosions are like a ripple effect that eventually like leads to a lot of the immigration that you get in the 1800s from those countries over into America, and really kind of takes us right into the story of the complete settlement of America and the American prairie and right up into modern agriculture. So it's kind of interesting that starts with somebody picking up a potato in the Andes and taking it over, and planting it in some Norwegian field. And the next thing you know, you have, Norwegians in Westby.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yes. There was a time, I guess, in Europe in the late 1800s where people just started leaving because there wasn't enough land for all the people, and it had been divvied up and divvied up and divvied up, and And so maybe the younger sons had to find someplace else to live. But as you say, when Columbus discovered America and, you know, opened it up and the Europeans started coming over, what did they find here? They found an empty land, almost empty.
Well, not at first. If people are interested in this subject, there is a book I would recommend called 1491. And it's a book all about what the Americas looked like the year before Columbus, you know, landed in Hispaniola. And it is a totally fascinating book. One of the basic things that they talk about in the book is the fact that we really have had a hard time getting estimates, getting our heads around the estimates of population levels here. But on the high end, it's believed that between when the Spanish first landed on the mainland, mainland Central America, and between like the early, even like the late 1600s, that 90% of the entire native population of the Americas died. And that often what you saw was that you can actually see this in the records of the conquistadors, by the way, because the conquistadors would say, go visit a place, like a thriving city, and then the next time they would go back, there was nobody there.
Oh, my goodness.
Because everybody had died.
And why are they dying?
Because of smallpox. And it wasn't that the Europeans purposely brought over smallpox, but the Europeans had cows, and cows are where we get smallpox from. There's a whole bunch of zoonotic diseases that will transfer from animals to humans that basically like the entire old world population have been exposed to in different ways. And actually very interesting to go backwards for a second. It's actually thought that part of what caused the decline of the Roman Empire was the first exposures of the Romans to smallpox, which they called the Antonine Plagues. And that this may have been, it really started sapping, it caused population declines in Rome. So even the old world wasn't, like the old world had just dealt with this already, you know, like 1,000 or 1,500 years before it came over and they introduced these things to the new world. But there were since the native populations in the Americas had no biological defenses against this, it just wreaked complete havoc. And then what it did was destroy these, it tore apart these societies. But there's these fascinating, in 1491, he details a number of very interesting things. One of them is that there was a group of conquistadors that came down and got lost in Peru and found this river, and they thought, oh, great, we're going to get on this river, and we're going to take this river back down to the Atlantic because this river's going east. But what they didn't know is they had just found, like, the headwaters of the Amazon, and so it took them months to get, right? But they went all the way down to the Amazon and back out to the Atlantic Ocean. But what they detail in this is that the entire way down the river, they encountered huge populations of people.
Oh, so it wasn't empty.
It was not empty at all. But then the next time any Europeans made it back to the Amazon, there was nobody there except for these indigenous tribes that looked like they'd always been living there. But now through recent archaeology, we've actually been able to show that there were actually cities in the Amazon, and that these tribes that we look at now are almost like the remnants of a broken civilization that went back into the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
And so And what was the basis of these societies was that there were these fascinating agricultural systems that had been developed here in the Americas. There was the corn-based system that basically powered. It's a little bit silly, but in my mind, it's almost I think like corn in North America and potatoes in South America, but it's not really that simple. They were growing maize in South America too, but maize and cotton, and peppers and beans and most of the cucurbits, that like the pumpkins and squashes. These were all things that were being grown in the Americas. And then in South America, you had potato, as well as that, tomatoes, many of the solanaceous crops that, you know, it was kind of funny, like we associate them now with Italian cooking, right? But really they came from South America. But even in the Amazon, it was been noted for years, for hundreds of years, that you could walk around parts of the Amazon and there was just like, there's all of these fruit trees everywhere and you could pick fruit from everywhere. And what they actually think now is that those are the overgrown orchards of these giant, of this, these Amazonian civilizations that were practicing like this form of rainforest agriculture. And so what you're seeing, what they were seeing in the Amazon when you could go around and just pick food was, it was, these were actually these ancient orchards. So so that's I think where we're going to go looking forward now is talk more about some of why these certain crops, why did we end up with certain crops from the Americas and not other crops. I think we're going to talk a little bit about maize because it's a very fascinating plant. It started out as this plant that looks very not like maize. It's not like when we talked about wheat and barley and oats, and it's like I can just walk out in Mesopotamia today and I can actually, in the hill country, and I actually find, you know, emmer and acorn wheat just growing wild because they're landrace wheats. I can't find that in the Americas with corn, because it was this breeding project that the peoples carried on that developed corn out of this stuff called zeaxanthin, and it looks nothing like corn today. So we can talk some about what maize is like and why it became such a base part of American agriculture today.
Well, it certainly is. But you also see, as we were talking before, that we're not really doing crop rotation anymore. We were doing crop rotation up to about maybe 1950 or 1960, and now you can drive, you know, across the country and just see plowed from highway to highway, sown in the same crop year after year. I mean, it seems like we've kind of forgot how we survived.
Well, I think one of the things that I really want to talk about as we get into modern, like the more modern times, is the interplay between governmental policy and what farmers do. Because if you go back and you look at that change, it has a lot to do with changes in how the government relates to agriculture. And I would say that as a basic thesis, farmers respond to the economic system that they find themselves in, but they usually are not the ones creating the economic system they're farming in.
Oh, how very interesting. Well, thank you so much, Alan. I've been talking with Alan Filo from Dodgeville, rural Dodgeville, and he's been leading us through some historical streams of agriculture. And I want to thank you all for tuning in to Digging In, and I hope that you will follow us. We'll be broadcasting a new show the last Saturday of each month at noon to 1. And I'm Philothea Bees, and I thank you so much for tuning in, and stay tuned.